I've gotten down here. The chef proves you were done. Just another second. The other class starts in about 1 minute. Thanks for it, one.
I gave you an assignment last week, is that correct? Is there anybody not on audit or who did it? Who's got it? Who can hand it in? Now, if I get these graded this week, I'll pass them back via the student mail. If I don't, they'll be in the library after school is out. Okay, back to observation. I was on a lengthy list of miscellaneous suggestions for observing structure. We had given you some 19 suggestions. The 20th is to let the nature of the material being observed dictate its own structure. Let the nature of the material which you are observing dictate its own structure. In other words, don't come and impose an artificial arrangement or an artificial structure on a passage that does not exist there. The nature of the material itself will dictate what the structure of it is. 21st suggestion, it's a good idea to ask yourself certain questions when you're observing the structure of a passage or observing in general. Ask yourself questions like, what is here? I know that's a pretty basic question, but sometimes it can be glossed over. Ask yourself a question like, why is it here? Now there's one less often asked. Why is it here? And don't just say, because it's the Word of God. You've got to do something with it. You've got to ask. You've got to answer that question. Or, why is it where it is? Now you're getting even harder questions. Why is it where it is? In other words, in relationship to the chapter that goeth before and the chapter that cometh after, if you're studying a chapter. Here's a good one. What difference would it make if it were omitted? What would be missing if this section was not there in the Bible, in this particular place as well? What difference would it make if it were elsewhere? What difference would it make if it were elsewhere? These questions will help you to make accurate observations. 22nd, observe chief characters, events, and ideas. Observe chief characters, events, and ideas, as well as indications of chronological and geographical movement, or, as the case may be, lack of movement. In the Gospels, there is a chronological movement, often, of Christ's life. Some cases there may be a lack of movement. You may say, my, been five chapters and it's been in the very same setting chronologically or geographically. He's been sitting on the Mount of Olives, or he's been down at the temple, or he's been there. Look for this. Look for indications of chronological or geographical movement or lack of movement. And then 23rd and last, use as much as is practicable, that's a word, charts and outlines to indicate your major structural relations. Because it's hard to keep them in your mind. Well, let's see, it flows from here to there, and it moves from this to that. It's hard to have that in your mind. If you can visualize it on a piece of paper, if you can see it on a piece of paper, I should say, you can visualize it a lot easier. Now, what kind of charts? What kinds of outlines? Well, I've taken the liberty to photocopy some examples from a book entitled Methodical Bible Study by A.B. Trainer. And these copies are from the Appendix A to the book. And I thought I would pass them out to you. Larry, maybe you can help me with one of these. Randy, you can help me with the other. It's an excellent book. It's a good book. Let me just put it out there. Thank you. In the interest of time, I will not seek to try to explain these to you. I think they're pretty self-explanatory. One is a chart of the 23rd Psalm, first part of it anyway. No, that is the 23rd Psalm, the whole Psalm. The next one, John 5, James 2, Joshua, and 1 Samuel. I think these are some interesting examples of how you can chart the flow of a book structurally. Okay, now I want to hit a new area under observation. But I'm going to hit this one briefly because I think you already understand it pretty thoroughly from your other classes and studies. But just to make you aware of it, and that is observation of general literary forms. How to observe or what to the fact that you need to observe general literary forms. Now, what do I mean by literary form? There are different kinds of literature, poetry, prophecy, and whatnot. And this element is different from the element of terms and structures. You can use the very same terms, in other words. You can even use the same structural relationships, but you can combine them to compose different kinds of literature. Poetry or prophecy, for example. You could have a poem and you could have a prophetic passage using the very same terms and the very same structural relationships and the very same material, but it could be composed in such a way that one you would call poetry and the other you would call prophecy, just depending on how it's laid out. And so, you must learn to observe what general type of literature is being used by the author, as well as the terms that are used, as well as the structure that we've looked at that is used. Remember, though, that various kinds of literature are sometimes used in combinations. It's not always a this or a that. It could be a combination of this and that. Plus, we realize also there are different means of classifying literature. All right, first, there is discoursive or logical literature. Discoursive or logical literature. And this includes extended discourses. It also includes ideas that are presented in argumentative form. Extended discourses and ideas that are presented in argumentative form. This would include, of course, the epistles, epistolary literature. It was almost always discoursive or logical. I suppose it would include also some of the prophetic sermons. I think an example, a good example, is the Book of Amos, which is put in an argumentative, discoursive fashion, enumerating the sins of various nations and Israel and the judgments which will come upon them and so forth. Prophetic sermons. I would say also the longer discourses of Jesus could be included in this category. This type of literature appeals primarily to the intellect, and that is its major earmark. I realize when I say that I'm talking about it from just a purely literary standpoint. I'm not saying it's not the Word of God, you don't get spiritual truths from it, you know, typology or whatever else, but I'm just talking about just from a superficial, surface, literary standpoint. It's the type of literature that appeals primarily to the intellect. Therefore, in interpreting this, the key is to look for a logical development of the idea. This is what's going to help you. Look for a logical flow and development of the idea or ideas that are presented in this kind of literature, and that will be a key to interpreting it, a key to look for, of course, in observing it, in your observation, which, of course, precedes your interpretation. A second form of literature you can call prose narrative. Prose narrative is found, for example, almost all of the Book of Genesis is prose narrative. Almost all of the Gospels is prose narrative. In other words, narrative is a story. You know how a narrator is someone who's telling you the story of his travelogue or whatever. So a narrative is a story. Prose means it's not poetry, it's a straight writing. So prose narrative. Now the purpose of prose narrative in the Bible is not to relate impersonal historical facts. That is not the purpose of it. That's the purpose of it in almost any other historical book, but not in the Bible. Rather, in the Bible, the purpose of it is to present what you could call evangelical or theological history. In other words, it's history with a purpose. Remember, we talked about purposive selection and that process of selecting certain materials and omitting other materials that did not serve God's purpose in showing you certain truths and lessons. And so, prose narrative is not just to relate facts per se, historical facts, but it's to present an evangelical or a theological history. And so you're looking at personalized history in the form of stories and biographical sketches. Obviously, this does not denigrate its historical value, for it is all true historically and is not ever making a false historical statement, but still it's history with a purpose. It's history with a slant, you might say. A good slant. Now, prose narrative, as opposed to logical or discoursive literature, appeals primarily to the imagination and to the emotions. That is the target. to the imagination and to the emotions. And therefore, if you're going to interpret it fully and properly, you must use imagination. And I mean that in its proper sense. I don't mean wild-eyed imagination, but I mean within proprietary bounds, imagination. You need to bring the mind into play in this area in order to fully understand it and interpret it. Third type of literature, poetry. Joel, Psalms, Proverbs, Song of Solomon, Ecclesiastes, Lamentations, portions of Judges, Genesis, some other places have poetry. I think there's three aspects that mark off poetry that are worthy of note when you're observing it. The first would be the obvious fact that it is full of figurative language. And so you've got to be careful that you don't interpret everything literally when you're looking at poetical portions of Scripture, that is actually going to happen that way as described or whatever. Much figurative language. Second of all, poetry is by its nature emotional. Poetry is emotional in nature. It is appealing to the emotion. It is trying to leave you with an impression. It is trying to affect you. It is trying to get a reaction in you. Third of all, poetry employs the use of parallelism. And of course there are various types of parallelism, antithetic and contrastive and comparative and so forth. You learned about those, I'm sure, in the Psalms class. We don't want to take the time to go over them now. Almost any book on Hebrew poetry or on the Psalms would talk about it. Bible dictionary as well. So figurative language, emotional nature, parallelism. The three earmarks of Bible poetry. Fourth, is a type of literature we could call dramatic prose. Dramatic prose. Yes.
Like the other ones, it was more logical development.
Interpretive key?
Yeah.
Well, I could make a contrast between logical and discursive literature and poetry and say you don't necessarily look for logical development of an idea in poetry. You look for waves, you look for repetition, you look for repeated things, and so you may not want to be quite as delineative in your exposition of poetry than you would be in logical literature, because you're not necessarily going to find that. You're going to find lots of repetition, and there will be truths that will be shown by the fact that something is repeated in a little bit different way and so forth, but you're not going to have, I believe anyway, the kind of rewarding study that you will when you get into the Pauline epistles and look at each word, each verb, each little thing separately contains worlds of truth. You don't find that in poetry. It's not that kind of a logical, detailed, analytical type. It's more of a heartfelt thing. It's more of an emotional thing. And so I would not generally do the same kind of a detailed study in poetical literature that I would in logical or discursive. Not that every word isn't there for a purpose or part of the Word of God. This is nothing to do with inspiration. That's just for the type of literature that it is. Also, the figurative language means, obviously, that you have to be careful when you're interpreting it to know what you interpret as literal and what you interpret as the figure that is standing for some other truth or something else. Dramatic prose involves personification. You're taking some element of nature or the world or creation, you're personifying it. You're giving it an arm, you're giving it an eye, you're giving it a heart, you're giving it a mind, you're giving it a mouth. It involves particularization, where we move from the general to the particular details that we talked about earlier. It also involves vivid description of events or ideas for the sake of their moving effect. For the sake of their moving effect. They want you to be affected by it. And so there'll be a vivid description of it. There'll be a personification of it. Obviously, this would therefore be closely related to a poetic expression of truth, but not necessarily exactly the same. Next, we have, and so some of the same statements that I made for poetry would hold true here as far as interpretation goes. Now, the liberals will take this one and run it into the ground, of course. The liberals will take you, or not even liberals necessarily, even conservatives that take an amillennial view of prophecy or something like that will look at descriptions of the millennium and the prophets, for example, of Jerusalem in the millennium and say, well, it's not really going to have this and that and that and the other. This is just dramatic prose. In order to be for vivid expression and to have an effect on the reader, he says it's going to be lifted up in a plane from here to here and this and that and the other. And you got to be careful there because you may not be looking at dramatic prose. You may be looking at narrative prose narrative or prophecy, really. It's prophecy written showing exactly what the thing is going to be like. So you've got to be careful not to take this one too far. Next, we have parabolic literature. Let me say that the Song of Moses and the Book of Exodus could be an example of dramatic prose. Obviously, it is talking about a real event. The horse and his rider has to be thrown in the sea, you know, Pharaoh and the chariots and so forth. But some of the statements, the way it talks about sinking to the deep as a stone or the earth opened up to swallow them and some of these other things may be hyperbolic expressions. It may be dramatic prose there in order, vivid expression, personification and things like that in order to really drive home the point that God did it, and when he did it right, and the enemy was utterly consumed, and Israel was saved. Now some would say, well, maybe it's poetry, so there could be debate on what you would look at that as being there. Now parabolic literature, obviously, is talking about parables, and when you're talking about a parable, you're immediately employing the principle of analogy, an analogy between one thing and another, from parabole, of course, to throw alongside. That which is thrown beside something else. So there's a truth, and God throws an illustration alongside the truth to illuminate the truth. A parable then consists of two parts, the spiritual truth that you're trying to illustrate, and the illustration, the brief physical narrative which is placed beside it for the purpose of clarification. And so parabolic literature has those two parts, the truth and the illustration of the truth. Good examples would be Matthew chapter 13, Mark chapter 4, Luke chapter 15. There are a few things to keep in mind when you're interpreting parabolic literature. I think one of the most important is to be careful not to necessarily press every detail in the parable as being something which has a counterpart in the truth that is being illustrated. Because sometimes in order to make the parabolic illustration cohesive and coherent, you've got to add things and put a whole little story there, but maybe there's only one or two parts of that story that you are using to point toward the truth that you're illustrating. And therefore, to press every detail in a parable for an analogous part in the truth that, you know, like it, as if it was a mirror image, for example, so that everything in the parable pointed to something in the spiritual truth, maybe is a mistake. The same thing is true in typology in a different sense. The whole life of Solomon cannot be used as necessarily a type of Christ. There are things that are there that are, don't typify. When they built the altar to God Chemosh and his wives took his heart away and so forth from God. See, so this whole life, only certain aspects of his life point toward Christ and the others don't. Only certain aspects of a parable point towards the truth and the others don't. Hand in glove with that truth is the fact that therefore you don't want to take other elements and necessarily read them into the parable. In other words, okay, there's a marriage, so they had to go here and come back here and it took so long, and the Hebrew customs means that he went there and there were 13 maidens here and they went here so long and they came back. In other words, reading things into the parable because you know from customs and so forth, and therefore trying to find how all of those fit necessarily with the truth. They may not be nearly as complex as we make them to be. That's a possibility, that they may be a lot simpler, and they may be showing a lot more basic, rudimentary concepts than what we make them out to be. Not that there may not be a lot in them. There is a lot in them, but sometimes we can read more in them, perhaps, than what is, and that may be why we sometimes come to dead ends in interpreting parables, because we're pressing it too far. Okay, the last is apocalyptic literature. Now, that's a word that's loaded with liberal connotation because many of the commentators talk about it, and they include with it, you know, non-canonical books and all sorts of other things, and they talk about apocalyptic eschatological literature, and, you know, oftentimes they denigrate the historicity of them and so forth. So, but nevertheless, there is a type of literature that you can call apocalyptic. In other words, apocalypse is such which is unveiled or revealed. Obviously, the two best examples in the Bible would be Daniel and the Apocalypse, or the Book of Revelation. They are apocalyptic literature, and they are a type of literature unto themselves. They're not like the Gospels. They're not like poetry. They're not like straight prophecy either, even though they are prophecy. They're a certain type of literary genre to themselves. They've got lots of symbolism that the prophetic literature doesn't necessarily use. Straight prophetic literature will just say, "Thus saith the Lord in the last days, this will happen, that will happen. Pour out my spirit upon all flesh." That's not symbolism, that's truth. He's going to pour his spirit out. But in the book of Revelation, you see, you know, beasts and oceans and horrors and dragons and this and that and the other. I mean, you see all kinds of symbols which are prophetic of things. You see descriptions of visions which are prophetic. So apocalyptic literature is a type unto itself. So these perhaps would be six of the major types of literature that you'll run across in the Bible, each with its own idiosyncrasies. And again, you've got to be aware of this, because like I say, they could be using the same term, the same literary structure, the same material, but they're put together in such a way that they are a different type of literature. All right. Now, yes?
The term prose?
Prose? I always just say straight writing. I don't know what, I couldn't give you a dictionary definition of it, but it's not poetic. It's the opposite of poetry. There's poetry where you're writing a certain kind of writing, and then there's prose, which is just regular writing. That's the best definition I can give you. Okay, another element that needs to be observed, we've talked about three elements in observation. We've talked about observing terms, the words, phrases, terms. We've talked about observing the literary structure. We've talked about observing the literary type or kind. We've talked about three things. When you're looking at the Bible, there's the terms, there's the structure, there's the type of literature, and here's the fourth thing, fourth and last thing that you will observe, and that is atmosphere. Atmosphere. Now, what is atmosphere? Atmosphere is what I would call the underlying tone or spirit of a passage. The underlying tone or spirit of a passage. Admittedly, it's the most intangible of all the elements that we have described heretofore, but nevertheless, it's real. It's there. Every passage has its atmosphere. Some passages have an atmosphere of despair. Some passages have an atmosphere of thanksgiving. Maybe one's got an atmosphere of awe, reverence. Others may have an atmosphere of urgency. Others may have an atmosphere of joy, maybe humility, tenderness. These are the types of things that we're talking about when we talk about atmosphere. There's a certain feel, there's a certain flavor that you derive from the reading of the passage, which is more than just the words on the surface of the page, but it's a certain feeling, a spirit that you get from it when you read it. That's the passage's atmosphere. Now, sometimes mere observation will not reveal the atmosphere of a passage. You may be able to take it apart and see its literary structure, define its key terms, and see what type of literature it is, and you still don't know its atmosphere. You may have to come to the stage of interpretation of that passage. And then once you've interpreted it, you can say, well, the atmosphere is thus and thus in light of its interpretation. Other times, you won't even get to the interpretation step before you'll already know what the atmosphere of it is. Mere observation of it will reveal it. But atmosphere involves a vital contact with the author's mind and spirit. You're going beyond the words on the page. You're going to the author's mind and spirit. What was he trying to convey? What was the upshot of the thing? And of course, ultimately, the author is the Holy Spirit. So you're getting, what was God getting at through this? What is the urgency? What is the tone here? Now, obviously, some passages may involve a combination of various moods or various atmospheres. In fact, there may be Minutes of scripture that have a drastic change of atmosphere from a mood of joy to a mood of urgency, from a mood of thanksgiving to a mood of awe or whatever. And so you've got to be very careful to observe all atmospheric elements or changes within a passage in order to fully understand it. So those are the four things in observation: term, literary structure, literary type, and atmosphere. And those four things make up every Bible passage. Okay, now I want to give you some aids to observation in general. Some aids to observation in general. And what I say now will apply not just to term, structure, type, or atmosphere, but just this whole idea of observing or studying the Bible. First, I recommend highly that you use a pen or pencil while you're observing. Otherwise, you may forget it. You may say, oh, I'll remember that term, but you may not. And so as you're studying through your chapter or your book, when you observe something, write it down right then and there. It will impress it upon your memory as well and help you to remember it. So you should always do that, and that's a habit you have to build. If you don't have it, you got to start it, because otherwise you'll just have the habit of always reading through it. And then when you get through, what was that other thing? There were three things I wanted to remember from that passage, and maybe you'll remember too, and you won't remember the other. It'll be frustrating, it's lost. And so it only takes a minute to jot it down real quickly while you're observing it. Now this is before you get to interpretation. Okay, we're not even talking about interpreting it yet. We're just talking about your initial perusal of these passages and examination of it. Just things that strike you as you're reading it. Write those things down. Now, when you observe a passage and you're sitting down, you say, all right, I want to study Colossians chapter 3, for example. How do you observe it? There are two basic approaches to the observation of any Bible passage. The first approach begins with a detailed noting of the particulars of the passage and then proceeds to an observation of the whole. I'll give that again. The first one, you start out with a detailed noting of the particulars, the details of the passage. Then you move to an observation of the whole. So it's from part to whole, from particular to general, from details to the entirety. That's one way of doing it. Then the second major way of observing is to start with a survey of the whole. Then you progress to noting the particulars. So this is the opposite way, isn't it? But this second one adds one part. After you progress to noting the particulars, you move to a synthesis of those particulars. So you start with observing the whole, you progress to noting the particulars, then you move to a synthesis of those particulars. For example, Colossians chapter 3, if I was going to do it the second way, I would sit down and I'd just read it. I would read it for reading's sake, the first time or two through. And I wouldn't be looking at term, structure, atmosphere, or anything particularly. I would just be reading it. I'd be surveying the whole thing. What is he saying? What is the point of this passage? What is the whole flow of it? Then I would go back and I'd start looking at detailed parts of the passage and noting these observations. So one, you're moving from particular to general. The other, you're moving from general to particular. And then you're synthesizing those particulars, meaning you're putting them back together again into a whole. Okay? Now, both types are valid, and both types are useful. It depends basically on what the purpose of your study is and how big a portion of Scripture you're studying as to which type of observational approach you will use. For example, the first one, where you read the particulars and then you read the passage as a whole, that involves the usual process that isn't involved when you're reading a passage, because you're starting at the beginning, you're moving term by term, phrase by phrase, clause by clause, to the conclusion. And this type of study is best when you're studying a relatively short passage. If you're studying a relatively short passage, that's a good approach to take. You just start right out with the particulars, term by term, passage by passage, and then you look at the whole. The reason being is because in a particularly short passage, the idea of perspective is not quite as important. And, of course, you're not going to get quite as good a perspective when you start right out with the details, but it's sure a lot quicker way to do it. And so when you've already got the perspective, or you don't need the perspective because it's a short passage, jump right into it and get into the details so you don't get off on a tangent, and then put them together. Now the second kind, then, obviously, would be best for a longer passage. If you're studying, for example, the whole book of Colossians, it would be best not to use that first approach where you get right into the details, because you're going to lose the forest for the trees. Use the second approach where you read the book as a whole. I would read through the book two or three times before I ever got down to the nitty-gritty of, you know, key terms, key phrases, key words. Now, you might notice a few key things in your first perusal and reading, and that's fine. You can jot them down, but that's not what you're looking for mainly. You're surveying the whole this way. And that way you get a better perspective. When perspective is essential in observation, use this second method. All right, next, there are two major errors to avoid in all observation of the Bible. The first error is to see the whole, W-H-O-L-E, without noting the details. And the second error is just the converse of that, seeing the details and then missing the whole. Both of those are traps to avoid in observation. It's not going to be proper, accurate observation to see the whole book of Ephesians as being, you know, the riches of Christ's inheritance in the saints, without noting the details of what that inheritance is, who the saints are, how that inheritance is given, what it entails, and so forth. You've got to see the details plus the whole. And of course, it's easy to do it the other way around. You've got all the details, but you don't see how they fit together. You don't see what the purpose is. You don't see the big picture, as they say. Therefore, observation should be both analytical and synthetical. Analytical means you're looking for details. Synthetical means you're putting the details together and you're seeing what the big picture is. Observation should do both. It should analyze and it should synthesize. Okay? In fact, when it comes right down to it, the purpose of analytical observation is synthetical observation. That's the reason you look at the detail, to understand the whole more better, don't you? Observation should always culminate with a view of the whole. It should always end up with a big picture. It should always end up with the larger perspective. Next point, fourth point in my list. The larger the body of material that you are studying, obviously, the less minute your examination of it is going to be. If you're studying the entire book of Romans, you are not going to be able to do a detailed, exegetical, term-by-term, analytical observation of it, unless you've got, you know, the rest of your life or something. I mean, you cannot, the larger, there's a ratio proportion here. There's a mathematical formula, and that is, the larger the body of material, the less minute your examination of it can be, okay? And they're in direct proportion to each other, the inverse proportion. Now, that does not mean that you give up. If you're observing a larger body of material, let me give you some tips. If you are observing like a whole book and you still want to get as much as you can out of it in the limited time that you've got. First of all, if you're observing a large body of material, scan it several times through. And as you scan it, note key, and I underline that word, key terms, key phrases, key statements. Also, make note of chief persons, places, and events. Not everybody, just the chief persons, the chief places, the chief events. Note structural units as you scan it. Note major relations. Note crucial chapters. Then, having done this, you can concentrate, you can go back into the book and concentrate on those elements and on those sections which you feel are the most significant for your study. And you won't end up trying to study the whole book when that's not your purpose. You want to hit key points, you want to hit key chapters, you want to hit key people, you want to hit key truths. And so, once you've scanned it a few times and written down what you think are the highlights, or need areas, then you go back and those you can study in a more minute way, because you didn't have time to study the whole book in a minute way. Now you have studied what you feel, have time to study what you feel is the most significant things from the book in a more minute way. But don't become entangled with minutia when you're approaching a long passage. That is a real trap, especially if you have a penchant for using reference works and word study works and language tools. You know, the thrill of victory there can be so great that it can lead to the agony of defeat when you get involved in minutia. And everybody's done that. I've done it, you've done it. Everybody's got off on a tangent and say, wow, I spent a half hour, 45 minutes tracing that word all the way back through and everywhere else it was used and everything else, and that isn't even what I was looking at. I was looking at this whole passage in view of the other. So look out if you don't get derailed on that line. Fifth, in recording your observations, try to enumerate them so as to make them distinct one from another. Enumerate means, of course, to give numbers to, or letters, or whatever system you use. Even if it's dashes, it doesn't matter as long as you're making a distinction between one observation and another. In fact, to go one step beyond that, in addition to making your observations distinct, you should also use some system in order to distinguish major things that are observed from minor things that are observed. Major and minor as to significance in your interpretation, of course. So some means, whether it's underlining, whether it's circling, whether it's outlining and using indentation or whatever you want to use, you should use some means to indicate your major observations as opposed to your minor observations. The less elaborate, the better, though, so that you don't spend all your time in the recording and annotations of these observations. Charts can be helpful to show main observations, especially in the realm of structural relations. And I would refer you to those photocopies I just handed out to you for further study. Find ways of organizing your observations so that they will be accessible with the least possible effort. And underline that word least, because time is of the essence, as you well know, in your study efforts. And so you don't want to spend all your time trying to find out what you've got written down, where it is, or why. In fact, in reference to that last word, why you wrote it down, often you will end up asking yourself why if you don't write down the scripture reference, chapter and verse for the observation. Otherwise, you'll write it down and you'll say, well, where was that? Or what was that in reference to? And so if you've got it written down, you'll know what it refers to. Next, sixth. Only write down that which is noteworthy. Don't write down everything that your eye sees, everything that clicks in your mind. Only that which is noteworthy should be written down. Don't list every V that appears in a passage. Oh, that's got the definite article. That's got the definite article. V, 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 V. You end up doing that, and you've lost the whole perspective on the article. Only those cases where the term V is significant should it be recorded in your observation. I think one case would be Mark 15:39, where the centurion said, surely this is the Son of God. Not just a Son of God, the Son of God. Obviously the V is worth noting in that passage because it's telling you something about the revelation that this Roman came to. Next, don't simply copy words down from the text, but indicate their significance when you write them down. In other words, let's take that Mark 15 example, although it won't be a real good one, but we'll use it. If you just wrote down Mark 15:39, V, and went on, or even the Son of God, you might come back to that a day later, cold, and you say, now why did I write that down? What is the purpose of that observation? I don't even know why I wrote it down. I don't even know what it is. You know, what good is, you end up throwing it out, usually, unless you can be lucky enough to catch your train of thought again. But if you write down, you know, note, not a Son of God, the Son of God, or something to that effect, had revelation that he was the Christ, what something that, why you wrote it down, then it'll be fresh in your mind, it'll be fresh later when you go back and look at your observational notes to make your interpretation of the book or further observations or whatever. And of course, be brief as possible in writing this down so you don't end up writing whole paragraphs for each observation or the process will become too tedious. But somehow indicate the significance of your observations when you write them down. Now we've talked about the four elements of a passage, the terms, the structure, the literary form, and the atmosphere. But obviously these need not be noted separately each time you are doing observational study. You don't necessarily look at a passage and say, all right, first I'll look at the terms. Then I'll look at the structure. Then I'll look at the form. Then I'll look at the atmosphere. You just don't study that way. It just doesn't work that way. Obviously, there are some things that must come before others. For example, you cannot see the relationship between terms until you have first observed the existence of those terms on the page. So obviously, by the very nature of Bible study, some things will always come before others. But what I'm trying to say is don't fall into a very hard rut where you think that you have to always do things in a certain order like this. Observation will always involve an intermingling of all these elements. But again, you need to be aware of the elements so that you do know what to look for in your observations. Next, observe, and this is a hard one to do, but it's really important. Observe every passage as if you had never seen it before. Now obviously, the more familiar you are with that passage, the harder this one is going to be. And nobody can do it totally. Nobody is totally objective. Nobody is totally, you know, open, or I guess is the word I could use, every time they look at a passage. You are influenced. Your thoughts are colored by how you preached or taught or studied on that passage before. But still, if you don't at least endeavor to do this, you'll never get any new truth. You'll always work the same veins every time you go into that gold mine, and you'll never see all the other veins of rich truth that are laying around about you. And so try to approach it as if you've never seen it before. Let every approach be a fresh one. One thing that's helped me is just to listen to other people teach and preach, even from other churches once in a while, on certain passages, and I see a whole brand new approach maybe to a passage I've never seen before. It's like it's so new, it's so fresh, and often maybe even the conclusions that they draw from their approach to it may not be all that revelatory, but the fact that they've opened up a new vein to me and a new approach to it gets me excited. I write it down and I can go back and study it with the light that God has given me and give what I feel are maybe more revelatory or significant conclusions based upon that approach. So try to let every approach be a fresh one, looking at it brand new again. Next, try to discipline yourself so that you can see how many different observations you can make on a given passage. Try to see how many different observations you can make on a given passage. Because chances are, your first pass through the park, once around quickly, you're going to make the more obvious observations. You're going to see the more obvious things. But the more you pore over that passage, the more you pray over that passage, the more you dig into that passage, I will guarantee you the more you will see. And I have learned this as a Bible college teacher because when you're required to have to teach on every verse in a book, you've got to know those verses. So you can't just gloss over it like somebody who's preaching and might read three verses, skip two and read the next four. You can't do that when you're teaching. You've got to go all the way through. You've got to force yourself to observe that passage and to study it until you break through and you feel that you understand what it is saying. And discipline is what it takes here, and stick-to-itiveness. Then you'll be effective. Then you'll be thorough in your observation. I'm reminded of that classic story called Agassiz and the Fish. How many have ever read that story? I think it's in the back of Jensen's book, Independent Bible Study. I think it's in the appendix. And it's a story, it's really funny. It's a story of this professor of entomology, study of fish, or whatever it is. And he gets a student, and for this test, this student has to look at this fish. And the professor gives him this fish in this bottle, and he says, I want you to sit here, and I want you to observe everything you can about this fish. I'll be back in 4 hours, or a day, or whatever it was, and you tell me everything you see. And so the story is this guy sitting alone with his fish. And he looks at it, you know, and he makes some of the obvious observations. Well, it's, you know, it's got fins on the top, dorsal fins and rear fins, and it's symmetrical, eyes on both sides, and this and the other. And then after a while, he pulls it out of the bottle, and he lays it down, and he looks at it. And he has a dialogue with it, you know. After a while, it looks disgusting, and then he hates it, and then he wants to give up, and then he sticks to it again, and then he starts, and then all of a sudden, he starts breaking through, and he starts, after he looks at it, he actually begins to see it. You know what I mean? You can look at something without seeing it. You're just looking at it, but you're not seeing it. After all, he begins seeing it, and he begins writing down all kinds of other things. In fact, I think what happened, the professor came in after about an hour and looked at it. And looked at what he'd written down. He said, you haven't even seen this thing yet. You've got a long ways to go. So he went what do you want? You know, the guy thought. And then he started looking at it, and he found the organs were bilobal and symmetrical and this, that, and the other. The next thing you know, he was off, and he had reams of information that he observed on this ugly fish that had been laying there in the, you know, formaldehyde for years. He came through with a real important truth about the need for persistence in observation. But we are usually too hurried and too harried to sit down to a Bible passage and do that if God doesn't lay it on us with a thunderbolt lightning revelation. The minute our eyes lay on the page, we think, well, there's nothing more there to be seen than what I've already seen or heard about it from it before. And when that is not true, you should pretend that nobody else has ever laid eyes on that page. Don't worry that Martin Luther and a million others have expounded the depths of that passage from their angles and their viewpoints. You pretend that you're the only one that's ever looked at it, and you work on that and mine it and get all the truth out of it that you can. Persistence. Next, the principle set forth by the following statement is an excellent aid to observation. Quote, an observer will have his eyes open to notice anything which, according to received theories, ought not to happen. For these are the facts which serve as clues to new discoveries. Unquote. Now, what did I say? We have a theology which says, well, God wouldn't do this, God would do that, Joseph wouldn't do this, Joseph would do that, Jesus wouldn't say this, Jesus would say that. In other words, we have a theology. Everybody has preconceived ideas about what will happen and what it won't happen. The minute you lay eyes on something that looks like it does not fit with your theory, something that happened which was not supposed to happen, something which was said which was not supposed to be said, at least according to what you believe, you better look at that closely, because it might be a new discovery for you. It might be a new revelation. You might have been wrong in thinking that God would never do that. Maybe he would. You might have been wrong in thinking that Jesus would never said that. Maybe you would. You might have been wrong in thinking that God would never expect that. Maybe he would. And so this is what you've got to keep your eyes out for. Not just the standard, you know, man-child rapture or whatever the things that you're looking for when you're studying. Keep your eyes open to things that don't seem to fit, because those can be some real keys to new discoveries. For example, when Joseph's scheming brothers came to him in Egypt and he revealed himself to him, to them, the gracious attitude that he displayed to them was probably the last thing that you would have expected just reading that. You would have expected retribution. You would have expected, a long spiel about how they mistreated him and so forth. The thing that he comes across with is so different from what you expect, knowing mankind and so forth, that you kind of take note of it and say, look at the grace with which he is treating his brethren. In fact, it's sometimes helpful to contrast that which you found in the passage with that which you did not find in the passage, but may be expected in the passage. And that's how you can develop more truths. Well, he didn't rail on him. He didn't accuse him. He didn't justify himself. He didn't do this, but what he did do was this. And you can gain worlds of truth by contrasting what is in the Bible with what could have been, with what the alternative actions, with what the alternative speeches, with what the alternative ideas could have been to what you are seeing on the page, and put them together. Then that tells you a little bit more about why what you see is on the page when you see the ramifications of what would have not have been on the page. Also, asking yourself a question the question implied in the following lines is often helpful. I'm going to read something else to you. You've heard this before. I have six faithful serving men who taught me all to know. Their names are what and where and when and how and why and who. An old little poem there, but those are still good to remember, those six things. What, where, when, how, why, who. Those six things. Or as Jack Webb would say, just the facts, man, nothing but the facts. And Dragnet, you know, I mean, that's all he wanted. He didn't want their opinion of who did it or why. He wanted the facts. And he put those facts together and, of course, always got the bad guy. And so we need to put the facts together and get the good guy. Next, notice any significant omissions as well as the events and ideas that are included. Robert Louis Stevenson once remarked, to omit is the one art of literature. If I knew how to omit, I should ask no other knowledge, end quote. So it's knowing what to leave out as well as knowing what to put in literature. And so you must note the author's omission as well as what he has put in order to fully know the author's mind. Okay? Next, compare and contrast your observations. Dr. Alexander Graham Bell, the inventor of the telephone, once said, "Observe, remember, compare. Observe, remember, compare." And that last thing of compare is what we're talking about here. Compare what you put down with what else you put down, or contrast it, as the case may be. Next, it is often useful to compare and to contrast various passages or books, such as the books, for example, of Kings with 1st and 2nd Chronicles, or the Minor Prophets with each other, or the parallel gospel accounts, or the Synoptic Gospels with the Gospel of John. Comparing and contrasting will often bring you truths that you would not see if you were limited to just one area or passage in the Bible. Okay, that's the last bell, and that's all we're going to be able to give you on this area of observation. So, we didn't get to interpretation and application, but I really didn't have as much in that area as I did in that area of observation to give you anyway, because a lot of it would have been kind of a rehash of some of the elements that you had learned in hermeneutics. Correlation, interpretation, application, some of the laws of interpretation, things to watch out for, and so forth. I think this area of observation was definitely the most important of these three things, and that's why we did spend the lion's share of the time, in fact all the time, on it. So hopefully this has helped you in your Bible study. Your papers, I guess I already mentioned, I'll get them back to you in the student mail if I can get them graded this week. If I can't, look for them in the library. Okay. Thank you. It's been a pleasure having you in this class. If you've got some more suggestions as to something you would like to see if you had the class to take all over again, some things that have come to mind as the weeks have gone on and you've done assignments, you've learned things and saw things, I would still be open to the reading of some of those so that next time through I can make it an even better class.
I was asked about one thing.